You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Ladies and gentlemen, can everybody hear okay? Yes, just checking the mics. For those of you who are standing at the back rather than sitting, there are seats here in the front. I can promise you that in spite of the tumultuous events the last few days, we on the panel at least don't bite. So please come and sit down here. And the door is over here if you want to escape. We won't say anything. I'm sitting close to the door as well. please do come and sit at the front, though, if any of you would like to have a seat. Well, it's been a pretty good turnout for this event. Perhaps not so surprising, considering the events of late last week. I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the Centre on the United States and Europe, and I have a confession already. I'm from the northeast of England, and every one of the places that I'm from or have a relative in voted to leave. So if any of you want to know some of the motivations, I can at least give some anecdotal as well as perhaps some informed analysis on that one. My mother, who is 82, is beside herself. She woke up the next day, didn't know anything that had happened. It turns out that all of her neighbours had voted to remain. And it was I broke the news to her in the afternoon. And she said, why did all these old people vote to remain? Vote to leave, I don't get it. So anyway, I'll have to explain to my mother now what's been going on as well. I have with me an all Brookings representation because this vote has had so many reverberations. We thought that it would be incumbent upon us to pull together a panel who could talk about this much more broadly. We at Brookings have been filling up our blog pages with an awful lot of commentary on this. If you go to the Brookings website, you'll see a lot of articles, including by my colleagues here on the panel. This event is going to be live webcast. You can follow it on, you can also tweet. I think some of our colleagues here are going to be tweeting as they're speaking here at hashtag Brexit. I'm delighted that there are so many representations from embassies from around DC here. And we want to do this much more conversationally. So I have here on the panel with me Aaron Klein from our economic studies program. Aaron actually worked for the Treasury, so Aaron will be your go-to person for all the questions about how this might have an impact on the US economy and many other topics as well. My colleague from the foreign policy program, Tom Wright, who has been writing a great deal about this. Tom is originally from Ireland. And you can be sure that the Irish have a particular perspective on this as well. We've actually got some people in the audience, including Tom Arnold from the Institute of International and European Affairs of Dublin, who happened to be in town today, and we've dragged him along to the event before he gets on a plane to go back to Dublin. So I might bring him in also to the discussion. And then Homi Haras, who, like myself, is actually also British, although he's been talking about the lack of utility of his British passport now that he used to use for travelling to Europe. And he used to work for the World Bank, and Homi is going to give us some of an insight on how this has had an impact on broader global economic issues. But I thought that I would start, first of all, with really asking Tom about some of his thoughts on how this is going to play out. We're all sitting here at a time when both of the main British political parties, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, are in a leadership crisis as a result of the referendum. Many people are, of course, asking what on earth was David Cameron thinking in holding this referendum in the first place. But Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, who was also supposed to be campaigning for Remain, has come under an awful lot of flack from his parliamentary party for putting what was seen to be a very half-hearted effort into the Remain campaign, and also from his grassroots, many of whom voted to leave. So both of the leaders of the main political parties are in trouble. And there's an awful lot of question about how this is going to play out in British politics. There's also the fact that Scotland and Northern Ireland voted rather clearly to remain within the European Union. Wales, where Welsh nationalism has actually remained quite a force, actually had an interesting split, although there was the vote to leave the EU along with most of the larger constituencies outside of London and some of the university centres in England, the vote there was a little bit more ambiguous. There were parts of Wales that voted to remain in the EU, like Cardiff, And Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalist Party, was actually more in favour, at least in some of the expressions that they had about remaining in the European Union. Of course, Welsh Labour Party were also talking about remaining in. So a lot of complicated questions to be resolved. Britain is clearly going to be in a state of domestic turmoil. And that's also going to have an impact on how the negotiation flows with the European Union. We just had the meeting in Brussels of David Cameron with the European leaders, meetings of the European Parliament, and meetings at the top level of the European Union. This was the week that was supposed to unveil the EU's global strategy about how the EU was going to be a global actor. And this has become a global actor, not perhaps in the way that it intended. There's a big debate now in Brussels as to whether Britain should leave quickly or whether there should be a little bit of a pause. There's certainly been a pause from some of the British politicians about how this should go next. So, Tom, how should we be looking at all this? You've written several pieces in the last couple of days about maybe slowing down something of the process, asking some of the questions about will there be contagion. I have here, many of you might have seen, Marine Le Pen's op-ed about the liberation, the people's spring, talking about the EU as the prison of peoples, quite a remarkable statement. So how do you see some of this playing out?
Thanks, Fiona, and it's great to be here. I think I would just start by saying, you know, the really remarkable thing about this result was, despite the fact that the opinion polls were very close and despite the fact that Eurosceptic feeling in the UK has been very high for a very long time, and despite the fact that a week before there was this terrible tragedy that people thought might sort of motivate the Remain voters to turn out in greater number, despite all of that, everyone essentially expected, you know, that the Remain vote would win. I mean, people did not think that there would be a Leave vote, not least the Leave campaign that seemed completely shocked when they actually won. I mean, on the night of the referendum, Nigel Farage conceded the result before the count even started. And then later on in the evening gave a speech, a victorious sort of speech claiming victory. But Boris Johnson and Michael Gove were nowhere to be seen, essentially. And so what transpired over the next few days was that there was no Leave plan. There was no 100-day plan to reassure Europe, you know, and the markets. Michael Gove, one of the leaders of the Leave campaign, his wife wrote an article today in the Daily Mail or some such paper where she said that they were completely shocked when David Cameron announced his resignation. They assumed he would continue on in office, and that was never the intention. So what essentially happened when this result was announced is that the Leave campaign found themselves in an incredibly important position, but with no actual plan. And then the things that the Remain campaign said would happen, which my colleagues will speak about in a minute, I'm sure, in the markets, all turned out to be true. There was a collapse in the price of the pound that tracked the result being announced, and there was doubts about investment in the UK. And so all of these pressures began to go thick and fast. And here we are a few days later, and there still really is no plan. Boris Johnson was meant to outline it in an article in the pay column in the Daily Telegraph a couple of days ago, and he did it. It sort of didn't meet expectations. And then yesterday he said he was sort of tired and emotional when writing about it and not to read too much into the article. This is the guy who's leading, you know, the campaign. This is the moment where he's meant to outline, like, his grand plan for how all of this will work. And as you mentioned, Fiona, the Labour Party is in a state of utter collapse, where the parliamentary party looks like it's going to split from the actual Labour Party and go into being an independent party. That's one real, you know, outcome if Jeremy Corbyn manages to retain the leadership, despite having lost a vote of confidence by 172 to 40. 81% of his parliamentary party opposed him. And on the Conservative side, there's a leadership contest in a few months. So I think that is, you know, that's a spectacle that is quite worrying, because whatever position you're in, you want to see some sort of stability. But in Europe, I think there is a division too. It's not quite as dramatic. And the division is between those who, as you said, want to go quickly and to have an exit, to have Britain trigger this Article 50 process, and maybe to punish Britain or give it a bad deal so it will be returned to others. And then the voices of caution, like Angela Merkel, who want a slower process to buy some time to see if there's, if not a way out, a way to sort of, you know, to cushion the fall. And then maybe at some future point, there may be a way out. And there's a division on that, particularly between some of the EU Commission leaders and the EU leaders and then the leaders of the European member states. And I think the member state side will probably win out in the end. But it's a very sort of volatile moment. There is a role, I think we'll get to later, for the US and all of this too. But I think it's, you know, markets and I think the political classes are very jumpy today.
Yeah, Homi, from the, looking at the much bigger picture on this, you know, obviously there was a lot of surprise in many places at the outcome here. There seems to have been something of a market recovery or at least maybe a readjustment to what's happened. I mean, how do you foresee this playing out and, you know, for what different reasons over the next several months on a more global scale?
Well, I think for developing countries, which is what I really focus on, and for poor people in developing countries, you know, yet again, here is an event which will affect them considerably, materially, and on which they have no voice and no say. And so, you know, if you just look at very short-term impacts, the UK is a big economy, and the UK is a very large aid donor, and they give, roughly speaking, £12 billion, used to be worth about $18 billion. Today, that's worth about $16 billion. So right off the bat, we've lost $2 billion of aid, which is not a small amount. Mm-hmm. And especially for the people who are, you know, on the receiving end, and there's not much you can do about those budgets. Developing countries have $1.5 trillion of sovereign debt denominated in dollars. What happens when there's uncertainty in global markets? The dollar basically strengthens and rallies. It's difficult to estimate exactly what the cost of that will be, but again, it'll be several billion dollars. What else happens? Risk premia have gone up. Flight to safety. Where is safety? It's not in developing countries. All these developing countries are facing higher borrowing costs. Next thing that happens, stronger dollar, commodity prices go down. All of them are losing from their commodity exports. If, as many people predict, the actual economies start to grow less rapidly, trade will grow slower. So there are, you know, layers on layers of these effects. Of course, they depend a lot on what will actually happen in terms of the management of the exit. But developing countries are basically places that live on the periphery of the global economy. And when the global economy becomes shaky, their economies become shaky. They feel it first, and they have fewer instruments at their disposal to be able to cushion some of these shocks. And so the impact of the shocks is higher. So I think that if we accept that we're likely to be in an environment where there is going to be some uncertainty about the global economy and the global politics and how all of this will essentially play out, it is going to be a rough period for many of these countries. And that's without even thinking about, will these really strong voices for the poor, which were represented by the UK, will they still be as strong, or will political attention perhaps be diverted to other issues? All of those things just come on top of these things. And, you know, development as an agenda in these situations always gets pushed down to the bottom. And then it's the poorest people who suffer and are, to some extent, left to bear Completely unintended, of course, but some of the consequences of these actions.
Well, this is a really important point about we're thinking about the political contagion, what might happen in France or the Netherlands or other countries that might have a referendum on the EU. But it's this kind of contagion that goes beyond the markets that we also should be paying attention to. There's two aspects of this that I wanted to push you on a little bit. One is the issue of remittances. I mean, this was actually one of the interesting articles that I saw recently, giving a breakdown of all of the countries that remittances were going to from the United Kingdom. Because you're talking about more formal state aid from DFID, the department that does international development in the UK, which has always been pretty generous. And there was a very strong outreach under successive governments to Africa in particular. But what was very most interesting to me was the large amount of remittances to Nigeria, yeah, and then from all of that afterwards to countries in the old British Commonwealth. There were not large numbers of remittances going to Poland, Romania, you know, Bulgaria, or any of the places that have become the focal point of ire within this debate. And some of the anti-immigrant sentiment that did come out as a course of the debate, which is not the whole story, and I think that might have been, you know, overblown in many respects. But part of the debate now is that there are parts of Britain that have been left out of the economic development that has been spurred by successive governments domestically, but also by the EU. Now, that those places will now be competing for development aid because they are relatively poor in relationship to London and some of the other big cities. So, I mean, how do you see that playing out from your own expert perspective?
Well, I think the remittances, the trade, you know, these are all aspects of globalization, and we've come to expect trends in all of these things to continue along trend lines. And when you go back 30, 40 years, you see all these trend lines basically gradually and continuously growing. And yes, every so often there are some hiccups, as there are in, you know, most economic trends and variables, but there was an unmistakable direction of where this was all headed. I would imagine that many countries and households will feel shaken about whether or not those trends will actually continue or whether this represents some kind of a turning point in those trends. So, you know, I do suspect that there are these much deeper questions around globalization. Mm. One of the things I think is interesting, though, is not to put too much emphasis on just the economics of this. Because the real people, in some sense, when one talks about how globalization has affected wages in advanced countries, etc., it's mostly how they've affected wages of young people. It's your first job. It's new entrants into the labor force. All of those people in the UK actually voted to remain. They weren't the people who were saying, let's leave. It's the people who aren't working. In some sense, it's the pensioners who have voted much more heavily for leave or exit. So that's perhaps not necessarily linked to the economics of globalization or the economics of technology change, because much of what is called globalization may actually be simply technology change, but globalization is a convenient sort of scapegoat or catch-all for many of these phrases. So if, and it's still a very big if, but if this represents a rethinking of globalization, that rethinking could be for better or for worse. We could actually end up with a better globalization. It's clear that the globalization we have right now isn't the best that we can imagine. So maybe this will be a wake-up call for political leaders across the world to, you know, take some notice of some of these things. And I would say that to some extent they've already started to do that. And so when you look at developments like the global goals for development that the UN passed, 193 countries at the UN unanimously agreed to in September of last year, They included many of the things that people now are talking about and worrying about. They included issues like inequality. They included issues like jobs. They included issues of fairness. So many of these things that now people say, well, we haven't just, you know, we've forgotten about these issues, people were aware of, included them in the plans for the future, but maybe too little, too late.
Well, Aaron, I mean, listening to this, I mean, all of these issues about inequality, jobs, fairness are very much the stuff of American politics right now. I won't draw you into the discussion of the political campaign, but certainly for, you know, someone with your background from the Treasury, you know, thinking about this on both the domestic front and the international front, you must have maybe some feelings of disquiet, as well as perhaps some questions about, you know, opportunities here too. I mean, one of the commentaries just recently in the last couple of days has been, you know, the US actually now looms even larger economically than it did last week, with the UK, you know, not out of the EU yet, and we have to, you know, underscore that. The UK is not yet out of the EU. It's just that everyone's talking as if it is, but it's not. But if it is, at the end of this process and the ways that, you know, people are envisaging, you know, the US is back there as being unassailably the, you know, the number one global economy. The EU, you know, drops down in a kind of an aggregate fashion. As Hamid's been talking about, there's been a run to the dollar as a safe haven. This has all kinds of different questions. I mean, how do you see this potentially unfolding? And, you know, what are your initial thoughts about it?
Yeah, so a few things. First off, I think the world is poorer as a result of Brexit and the UK's choice. But I take Hamid's point that economics only has so much to show and teach us about trade-offs between wealth and sovereignty, right? There is a, they've traded less wealth for more sovereignty. That's not necessarily irrational. If I offered anyone here infinite wealth and zero freedom, would you take it? So, but when Britain made that choice between wealth and sovereignty, that has a series of domino effects. Give myself an accent profile for a moment relative to my panelists to focus on the United States, because a lot of these trends will have a huge impact in the U.S., even though the U.S. is the most domestic economy of all major economies. And even though more than 80%, I think almost if you did the math better than our official estimates, you'd get closer to 85% of our economies domestic, you know, mortgage interest, you know, people are going to start refinancing their houses because of Brexit, because this flight to dollar-denominated safe haven assets have pushed down interest rates. And we all thought at 3 7/8, you'd never get a cheaper mortgage. Well, wait. they're going to, you know, we're going to see disinflation. The stronger dollar pushes down prices of commodities, which makes inflation look even lower. It's impacted the path of monetary policy. The Federal Reserve had made one interest rate hike and had been talking about gradually increasing rates. Well, two things have happened, right? Number one, the impact of rate increases now are going to be even larger than before. The stronger dollar acts as kind of a megaphone and amplifying impact, particularly because Europe and the rest of the world facing us and the United Kingdom facing slower growth, facing higher recession probabilities, are going to be more likely to try other methods to lower rates and stimulate growth through monetary policy, which will exacerbate currency price differentials even further. So there are going to be large impacts domestically. The United Kingdom is our fifth largest source of our nation's exports. So, you know, the price of a Ford just went up 10%. The flip side is a Mini Cooper is $2,500 cheaper. And, you know, that has impacts not just on us, but has impacts on Japan. The yen has rallied substantially. So it's not just the United States. I mean, I was asked earlier today by a reporter, you know, is this local contained or is it global? It's very much global and will impact Americans in ways you least expect it. On the political side, your point about remittances, I think, is really important. That was one of the areas where remittances from the United States are more than 10% of GDP to 4 or 5 countries in this hemisphere. At one point, people were paying more in exchange rate fees in remittances if you added them up than some of our official development programs from the United States government to major countries. I'm proud to say Dodd-Frank, one of the acts I worked on at Treasury, actually created a more transparent market to use these remittances. But you saw remittances dry up in the wake of the financial crisis in the United States. And when you see Donald Trump talk about his plan to pay for the wall, and those were his words, not mine, because it's a nonsensical document that's both dangerous and unworkable. But it involves cracking down on how everybody in this room would use their bank account to wire money overseas in an attempt to force Mexico to, quote unquote, pay for the wall. But my point on that is, you know, the topics of migration, immigration, and globalization and markets are getting amalgamated into this one binary choice of stay or leave. And those different effects, as you kind of unfurl the ball of yarn and you pull on the strings, have very different impacts for different folks and could pretend to be extremely disruptive to the United States economy. So, you know, my message is, just because it looks like the market has kind of snapped back and the Dow seems kind of closer to where it was before, you know, don't think that Brexit has kind of washed past our shores. The effects are going to be here to stay for quite a while.
Do you have any thoughts on the political effects of this? And I'm going to bring Tom in on this as well, because Tom's been actually writing, you know, quite a bit about U.S. Domestic and foreign policy as well. But we famously had Donald Trump on a golf course in Scotland, Scotland that had just actually voted to remain in the EU, you know, complimenting Britain on, you know, getting its country back, saying, you know, the U.S. is next. Well, what is the U.S. leaving? You know, so and that's
NAFTA,
what I wanted to ask you about. Well, you know, how do you see this
China,
playing out?
Globalization. So a couple things. Number one is it's very important for people in this room to appreciate how much of a bubble we're in this room.
Right.
So there was a poll on Wednesday, the day before the vote. 75% of Americans had never heard of Brexit.
75%.
Three out of four.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not going to poll, you know, who hit the game-winning three-pointer in Cleveland, Golden State. I suspect you'd, you know. So 75% of Americans never even heard of it. So don't overestimate America's attention span and interest in these things. And especially when the market falls 1,000 points in the day, everybody, that starts to resonate. But the core forces at play are very much the same. I think both Tom and Hami have talked about youth vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and ran the numbers, and if youth under the age of 30 voted at the same rate as people 35 to 45, just participation rate, I'm going to hold their choices the same, we wouldn't be here today. Britain would still be in. Youth voter turnout made the entire difference. One could look at this lens here. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that. And youth voter turnout is very marginal in the American experience. There is a huge age gap between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, people are looking at polls and saying, oh, you know, the Bernie bros aren't going to Trump, so Hillary's, you know, put that. Well, there are multiple options in voting, one of which is don't. And that's a big impact here, right? Number two is, you know, the impact, I would say, one reason though I'm less, think that this is less overblown here, is I was kind of blown away by this, and maybe you guys as Greater Britain, United Kingdom experts, the United Kingdom is 85% white, and the United States is 61% white, not Hispanic. And again, I don't pretend to fully understand the different ethnics, but I think there are greater racial and ethnic divides in play in the U.S. election that are pushing against perhaps some of the forces you saw in the United Kingdom, where, you know, both conservative and liberal parties kind of found this joining. And I think that's in play here, not because of the substance of the issues about trade and globalization, but because of the racism and attitudes of the candidate most affiliated with kind of American leave.
Well, where Britain looks most like the United States is actually in London, where, you know, you had a very different outcome from the rest of the country. That's the most diverse part of the United Kingdom, and, you know, Tom and Hamid can talk about this. The places that voted to leave were predominantly the least diverse parts of the country. My hometown, for example, only has 8% of the population from somewhere else. That somewhere else can also be defined in many different ways. But these are places that very much also fit some of the demographics that you're talking about the base of support for Trump and, you know, some other candidates in the presidential election campaign who felt that everything has passed them by. If you go to the BBC website, where they've done a lot of very interesting interviews with voters, you know, around the election, a lot of people from the northeast of England said, "Well, we've been forgotten up here. You know, they've forgotten us. Nobody knows we're here." So there was a kind of a shout about, "Hey, we're still here. We've been passed by." This goes to, you know, some of the things that we've already talked about. And we're going to, you know, shout and make our voices heard. They probably didn't anticipate that their voice would be heard in the same way. And that is obviously playing in to the US political campaign. And that's, you know, where some of the research that some of our colleagues here have done, like Gary Bertless here at Brookings, who's done some really great work on, you know, the white America, the permanent underclass that has developed with very poor health outcomes, chronic rates of unemployment and underemployment. The UK government actually keeps an index of deprivation in the United Kingdom. It's been a surveys and a series of databases they've kept since 1984, so actually not that long, really. But if you actually hold up the indices of deprivation from the United Kingdom and voting patterns, you can see a very strong correlation. And deprivation is access to education, access to healthcare, another factor that plays very strongly in the United States, as well as people's perceptions about the opportunity, which I think that's what you were talking to about, Homi. It's opportunity, not just economic living standards or anything. And also housing ownership. I mean, all of these issues that play into American politics as well. So I think there are some structural parallels, but obviously the United States is a much more diverse place. I mean, Tom, you've been writing quite a lot about this, also about the US political situation. What lessons can we take away, being reasonable about this, for the US presidential campaign?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the aftermath of the financial crisis of 08-09. I mean, the slow rate of recovery, the lack of global growth, the lack of national growth, and the sense that one's domestic situation is precarious partly because of these mysterious global, you know, forces, I think has, in a slightly delayed way, resulted in a populist, rebellion that says, you know, we need to find national solutions to these international problems. And part of that is to insulate yourself to some extent or to do things, you know, domestically that wall yourself off from some of this international, you know, volatility. And if you think about Trump's message, I mean, his message is essentially, you know, you're getting screwed here at home because foreign nations are exploiting you or taking advantage of you. And the UKIP position and its sort of emphasis on sovereignty was something, you know, similar. Now, the official Leave campaign's position wasn't quite, you know, that crude, but it did have the common element of sort of blaming the international for the domestic and saying that there were simple solutions. And the thing is that part of that, you know, reflects real anxiety. Now, you can say that, you know, given that the financial crisis was, you know, the most severe shock to the world economy since the 1930s, that actually it's not so bad. But that's not a message that sells politically, right? You can't win an election by saying it's not as bad as the 1930s. And so people want a different, you know, standard, and they are entitled to that. But the message that populists have doesn't have an agenda for global growth. It doesn't have sort of a positive sum, you know, agenda about how this works for everyone. It tends to be more zero-sum. It's all about winning, beating another country in a negotiation and getting more than you would otherwise have gotten. I think that's sort of the common thread between them. I would make just one other point, which is I think it's important, which is that the Brexit crisis is a symptom of the broader European crisis and not a cause of it, right? I mean, the reason why this happened is largely because of the Eurozone crisis and the sense that the EU isn't working. This was unthinkable prior to 08, 09. I mean, literally unthinkable. There was a big argument in the Tory party about not integrating more into Europe, about not joining the euro, all of that, but it wasn't about leaving the EU. That was very much a fringe idea. And the political contagion risk is real, but it stems from this perception and maybe the reality that the EU has serious problems and is not working effectively. It's not actually because of the Brexit vote. I mean, there are very few, if any, countries that are going to follow the UK and follow its example simply because the British people voted to leave Europe, you know, last week. But there are people who will resist needed steps on integration or throw out governments that are seen to be pro-European because they're very frustrated with the EU. And I think that's the challenge, really, that European governments have to deal with, which is how to restore growth in the Eurozone and more broadly in Europe. And if you get high levels of growth, then I think not all of these problems go away, but quite a lot of them are significantly eased. And with that, I'll wait for my two economist colleagues to completely dismantle what I just said.
Yeah, I was going to say, how likely is that? Yeah, I mean, would you react to that in terms of the prospects for stimulating growth under the political crisis that we find ourselves in?
I think even before all of this, there was a great deal of nervousness that we are in a period of a long-term period of much slower growth. And you know, Larry Summers has talked about secular stagnation and whether it's stagnation or low growth, but regardless, there does seem to be substantially lower growth everywhere. But I did want to comment actually on your point about the difference by place. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about countries, and we still think about, you know, what's happening to this country or that country. And actually, I think that what we're seeing is that the real economic impact of globalization is very, very different in different places and regions within countries. And this is a lot of this is about those kinds of regional imbalances. And it's much harder today to actually adjust that. So obviously, London has benefited, you know, tremendously. As has, in this country, the Northeast Corridor. Washington is booming. New York is booming. But secondary cities are often actually doing quite poorly. And when they're secondary cities which had a concentration with one particular industry which might have just left, it's very hard to then recover and to generate a new local growth model. And so I think that we've really underestimated some of the costs of adjustment when they are so spatially different. And actually, this is thankfully not a problem that many developing countries have because they don't have the big secondary cities that are then going into decline. They're still, many of them are still in the process of forming cities.
And Nigeria is a great example of this.
Right, so it's just a matter of where do I go? Do I go here or do I go there? It's not, you know, I was in the city here and now it's no longer as productive economically. So this idea of losses and how one deals with those kinds of losses and that when losses are heavily concentrated and reach a critical size, then adjustment becomes even more costly, I think is something that we really haven't factored in a real way to many of the adjustment programs. So it then doesn't become any longer just a matter of a job retraining program or something like that. It's that there are no jobs in that particular area and locality, and how far that spreads is, you know, still a matter of considerable debate.
This raises a number of questions, you know, for the U.S. as well about mobility. We've had a lot of studies recently shown that mobility is actually at its lowest right now in the United States. And we were obsessed about migration and immigration of people coming into the country. But people within the country are finding it harder to move. And that's exactly what had happened in the United Kingdom. People in these secondary cities couldn't really move to London because the barriers to entry are too high because of house prices. You can't sell, you know, a house in Sunderland and, you know, expect to buy anything more than a shed or perhaps a parking space in London if you're lucky. And that, I'm not joking about that. You can do some, you know, Googling online and find that, in fact, that would be probably what you could hope for. And from the even lower down the small towns, even moving to a larger city becomes problematic. And I think we've seen the same thing in the United States, where it's perceived that immigrants, the barriers to entry are lower because they're prepared to actually suffer a great deal of hardship and make all kinds of accommodations because they're already improving their life by moving out of wherever it is that they've moved. So, I mean, in the United States, I mean, how are we seeing that playing out as well?
So I think, I mean, I think a couple of things. One is I'm a little less sanguine than Thomas on the ramifications of this. First, I am more concerned about the possibility of disintegration within the United Kingdom. So kind of an internal disintegration, because you could ask yourself, you know, if the United Kingdom has chosen sovereignty over wealth, has it created a situation, or Great Britain has it created, can Scotland improve wealth and sovereignty?
Right.
Right? And then the second thing is you look, and Pew just came out with a study in France that showed France is pretty high lack, I think second behind Greece, and was a little higher than the United Kingdom on kind of being upset with the European Union. You point out Le Pen, who seems all but certain to get into the runoff in their next election. And you kind of ask, you know, the similarities with Trump over here. We're kind of very focused on Trump, but there are plenty of similarities with the Le Pen movement. And you ask yourself kind of, where is this core coming from? The last point I point is there's been a loss of confidence, and here I agree with Thomas, in institutions, a loss of confidence in forms of government. Mm-hmm. And I think I look back on my time in the United States and my time at Treasury, and you know, there was a legal requirement that was just recently revised, but for years and years, it was Treasury was required to issue a report to the American public about what nations were manipulating their currency. And under the first Bush administration, then Treasury Secretary Brady used it, and you know, effectively, in my opinion, to point out certain Asian countries, predominantly Asian countries, but there were some others that were manipulating their currency for unfair competitive trade advantage. And there were negotiations and dialogues in late 80s, early 90s. And then there was a long period where no country was ever designated, including China, during a period where I think, you know, serious people would have to acknowledge that that was part of China's explicit strategy of currency manipulation. And the government used all sorts of creative words that were synonyms for manipulation, but never used it, even though it didn't really trigger anything that much more than additional dialogues which were already taking place. But there was and Congress at certain points in the Senate voted, Schumer had a bill, there were certain votes by Congress registering their disapproval at this. But for geopolitical purposes, China was never designated manipulation. In the long run, I wonder how much does that feed into the lack of credibility of institutions and governments and experts that was driving, I think, part of the view in Brexit, but also driving part of the view in the Trump campaign.
Well, that's a major point, as we all sit here as experts on this panel. We certainly should feel very concerned about that. I mean, one of the big points, as you rightly underscore in the Brexit campaign, was that people didn't really believe any of the facts that they were presented with. We actually had an event here at Brookings on May 6th. Some of you, I know from looking around the audience, were actually here, where we had brought over a group of colleagues from the United Kingdom, from universities, who had received a big grant from the National Research Council in the UK to actually try to lay out the facts on both sides of the campaign, both Leave and Remain. And frankly, even as you know, someone with quite a lot of background on this and reading this, it was very hard to weigh this up. It was very hard to kind of weigh out, you know, where this all came down. And it was very difficult for anybody who was in the campaign to be able to refute all kinds of spurious claims that we've now seen, you know, various people backtracking from. So I think we're obviously in that same space here where, as you point out, 75% of the US population hadn't heard anything about Brexit beforehand and are very unlikely to be really into the nitty-gritty of the facts that are being thrown out in our own presidential campaign. I think I'll use that as a segue into our very well-educated and, in fact, in some cases here, representative audience of some of the interested players in this. I can see actually here many people who I know have a perspective on this point. I've got some colleagues here who are representatives of the European Union, from the British Embassy, a colleague who's sitting here in the front row, originally from the UK, Geoffrey Harris, who's the outgoing deputy representative of the European Parliament's liaison office here with US Congress. Geoffrey actually started his career with the British referendum for going into the EU in 1975, and he retired a week ago, just before the Brexit referendum. Geoffrey and I are talking about his memoir that she will be coming out soon about a British civil servant and representative in the EU. I know he'll have something to say. I mentioned before Tom Arnold, he might have actually gone from the Institute of International and European Affairs in Dublin. And many other people here who I know may all have something to say. And as I said, we'd like to have this as a conversation. I'm going to ask Geoffrey to make a couple of remarks. This is Geoffrey's last day here in the United States. He's going back to Brussels to live. Good luck to him. I think he maybe needs more than a glass of wine. But Geoffrey,
I won't lay down the law or anything about what has happened in my country up until today. I think what Tom has said about this being a sort of not just Brexit, it's an overall crisis of the European Union, which has clearly been building up for a number of years. The President of the United States made some points yesterday, whether they were exactly correct, I don't know, but he was more or less on the same track. But basically, the question is how to go forward. And it's not a question of being pessimistic, optimistic, or making any kind of prediction. I would just point out to you that Britain remains a parliamentary democracy. And the issues, you mentioned the whole problem functioning of institutions. This really does go back to the 1970s, because probably the only British politician who made his whole career around the European idea was a chap called Roy Jenkins. He was the deputy leader of the Labour Party in one of these early power struggles within what was then a relatively strong Labour Party. He gave up his position as deputy leader because the party decided to have a referendum. And he said, so that's a matter of principle, I'm not going to stay. He had led the group of rebels who had provided the government with the majority to get in the first place. So he was used to being in the trenches. He then led the victorious campaign in the referendum and then went on to be president of the commission, and then Labour Party fell apart for a whole lot of reasons. So the idea of referenda to solve this issue wasn't new, and maybe Mr. Cameron thought because it was so obvious that the British people would vote to stay in. The other thing of the question of Scotland has been building up also for 40, 50 years when the SNP had one or two members and one sensational by-elections have gone to a situation where today the First Minister of Scotland has flown into Brussels with a unanimous, almost unanimous mandate. But my question, and just one specific point, since we are at Brookings, you're going to talk about globalization. But let's not exaggerate this element. Boris Johnson and Michael Gove don't really care that much about globalization, but they do, no doubt, sincerely care about the constitutional issues. And, of course, the losers of globalization, if you want to define the people of Sunderland or whatever, as that influenced the result, and maybe a slightly more enthusiastic Labour Party leader could have just tipped the balance and it would have been okay. But it wasn't really about globalization. It was about Brussels bureaucracy, sovereignty, and so that's the issue which now has to be resolved. But the thing that has struck me, and you mentioned Mr. Trump, I wouldn't, it's not up to me to dish out any prizes. But he did appear to me up until Thursday, you mentioned the overwhelming ignorance that Brexit was an issue, to be the only politician, apart from the president who had come in to help his friend Mr. Cameron earlier on, he was the only politician who I'd identified this as an extremely important event. And I'm prepared to be corrected. I do not believe for 1 millisecond that he flew into that golf course in Scotland by pure chance on the morning of what turned out to be one of the most important events in Western history, whatever happened. So we're still a parliamentary democracy. We might have another referendum, I doubt it, but you still have to get a majority in Parliament to start the Article 50 procedure, let alone to finish it, and there's a very, very long way to go until we get to that stage.
Thank you, Jeff. Very important point. I don't know if any of my other colleagues... perhaps you can sit and think about this. I also have a colleague here from the EU. But the gentleman here at the front, will we have the microphone? Yeah, and please identify yourself as well.
Oh, thank you. Should I stand or stay seated?
Yes, whatever.
I just wanted to ask a theoretical, first of all, my name is Matthew Soper, but to ask a theoretical question, which was touched on just here, there's actually still... a legal issue at play, and that's the fact that the EU Referendum Act of last year didn't mandate what happens regardless of how the vote takes place. So Parliament could decide that they're not going to act on this issue, mm-hmm. even though the world markets have already acted. The FTSE's gone crazy. The pound has gone crazy. So what now? I mean, we have a legal issue. We have a political issue, but potentially Parliament doesn't have to act at this point in time. And what would happen?
Well, I think let's address some of this. I mean, Tom, this has been an issue that we've all been talking around the water cooler about as well, because this is exactly, I think it's on everyone's minds in London, in the politics, as well as in Brussels.
Yeah, so, I mean, firstly, on this Article 50 process, which has to be sort of officially triggered, and then there's an automatic exit after 2 years, cannot be suspended unless all the member states agree. The UK does not want to trigger that in the immediate future. Cameron, I think, did something really smart when he said he'd leave it to his successor. That was partly on principle, but I think also to buy time, because if once you get into that process, the rest of the EU has all the leverage. Right, and so the UK has very little leverage and is sort of captive to the demands of other countries, which have started to come pretty thick and fast. So within 24 hours, Spain said it would require joint sovereignty over Gibraltar as a condition of any future relations deal. And there are other sort of red lines, you know, as well. So the UK wants to buy time. It definitely won't happen before there's a new prime minister. When the new prime minister takes office, whether it's Theresa May or I think probably will be her, but or if it's Boris Johnson or even someone else, you know, you could easily say that they want some time to get established before actually triggering Article 50. And they may set the point as being after the French election because it would be hard to get anything done before. So we're really talking potentially in a year's time, right? I mean, that could buy up to a year. Now, the rest of Europe has sort of been quite adamant that that is too long. Merkel, while she said that there should be some time, has said, you know, they've been indicating it's around 3 months what they have in mind, not a year. Others have said immediately, but there's no way of forcing it. There's no way of forcing it. And so Britain can hold out on this for as long as it wants. Domestically, it may be difficult to do it indefinitely. It's probably impossible, but certainly they can buy some time, slow things down, and try to figure out sort of where things are. On the second referendum, I would just say I do think this is a possibility, but it would require a lot of things to happen. It would require everyone wanting to reverse it, which is not obvious that would happen. You know, you are expecting people to be reasonable, but there may be unreasonable people and, you know, developments that just mitigate against a reasonable negotiation. You would probably need a general election, and you would need a coherent Labour Party that would actually make a second referendum part of its platform. And then you couldn't just have a second referendum to reverse the vote. I think you would need to have it on something else. So it would perhaps have to be on the terms of the negotiation that the UK government got to leave. And then you would say, you know, well, In 2016, you gave the British government a mandate to negotiate an exit. Now they have negotiated an exit. Now you decide, is it what they promised initially, or does it fall short? And so you give them that option. And I think that's quite democratic. You know, it's not very British for the reasons you said, because referendums aren't very British. And I agree with Lord Jenkins. I think you can certainly make a principled case against it. But, you know, the genie being out of the bottle, you could make a case, but that would be more 2019-ish rather than in the next 12 months.
So the only point I would add is that delay has cost.
Right. Yeah.
Right. There's an economic uncertainty. I do a lot of work in financial technology, and up until last week, London was well positioned to be the global leader in fintech. Mm-hmm. They had a great regulatory regime. The U.S. was trying to catch up. The White House had an event, the OCC, et cetera. Well, if you were starting a fintech firm right now, would you want to start it in London?
Well, the other aspect of this that Jeffrey touched on, that you actually raised as well, about the future of the UK, plays somewhat into this response that you had, Tom. As Jeffrey mentioned, Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, also flew to Brussels. Not everybody met with her, but she was clearly making a pitch for the consideration of Scotland and its decision, at least the voters' decision in the referendum, to remain. And also because the Scotland's status within the United Kingdom at the referendum on independence, another referendum back in September 2014, seems to be to a large part determined by the fears of Scottish voters about the likelihood of being outside of the European Union if they voted to leave the United Kingdom. So we've kind of gone full circle again back to some of the issues that were raised in that referendum. There's been some speculation in the press that perhaps Nicola Sturgeon could use the very large number of SNP members of Parliament in the UK Parliament, in Westminster, not just in, obviously, in the Scottish Parliament, to try to block in some way this movement towards the triggering of Article 50, or perhaps call for some new referendum. And how likely is that to play out? And then, of course, there's the Northern Ireland aspect of this too. Yes, this is to you. Homie's looking at me kind of, why are you asking me this? But I'm asking you this, Tom. But you can also have comment on this as well.
I have no comment.
Scotland, I mean, clearly there are big implications for Scotland. I don't disagree with anything you said, but I think we need to be a little cautious before saying that Scotland's about to leave the UK, because there are several barriers. For one, they need a second referendum on independence, and it's by no means certain that a Conservative government will grant them that. Certainly in the near term, they could say, they could put it off to the next parliament, they could deny it overall. Scotland can't have it unilaterally. If they have it unilaterally, it's illegitimate, it has no legal standing. So, you know, when you put that to Scottish independence supporters, they say, yes, but that will cause a constitutional crisis and a standoff. Yes, well, maybe, and that may very well be true, but it does sort of, still, it's a fact that it's not an automatic procedure. The second thing is that, while I think you're right, that being outside the EU was a factor in them losing the independence referendum, the larger factor was the currency question and other issues,
Sterling,
which remain unresolved, and in many ways are exacerbated by a weak England. And so if you have a weak English economy and a weak overall economy, to actually have Scottish independence in that circumstance, you know, is not great. And it's in an international context where the price of oil has plummeted from what it was. And so the oil plan for revenue doesn't hold up either. None of that is to say that Scotland won't become independent, but I think that they have a number of obstacles to overcome. And then they also have the problem within the EU, where Spain and others don't want the precedent to be set for Catalonia and other secessionist movements. So I think that this Scotland thing is very real, but we're looking more at a five-year timetable rather than something that's going to happen at great speed.
But could Scotland and Northern Ireland both make a pitch now in some form? I mean, this makes it quite complicated to think how they would do this, to slow this down and be able to maybe also put a brake on some of the demands from the EU to move more quickly. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think they will, and I think the Irish government will, you know, and is already sort of arguing to slow it down, and will sort of use the peace process in Northern Ireland as a reason. Mm-hmm. I think many European leaders will find it difficult to resist that logic, because that is something that Europe has a role in. You know, that is one of the great achievements of the last sort of 20 years in Europe, and there'll be a lot of sensitivity to that.
Aaron's point about the youth vote is also very interesting, because we've seen protests by students who didn't vote for a variety of reasons. Some, you know, because they didn't see the importance of it, others because it was actually difficult to vote. And now, and a lot of protests, and a number of EU parliamentary officials saying, you know, students of Britain, we remain with you. I mean, this is a kind of an interesting development here, but I mean, I don't know whether Homi or Aaron, you might have some thoughts about, you know, student movements and, you know, how likely that might be to change things. Because you, you know, talked about the economics of this on the youth side. It's about opportunity. And obviously, there's a very high opportunity cost now for students within the UK, as well as EU students who like to study in the UK, and the impact that this could have on the British education system.
Well, I think the old trade-off, you know, should I have a beer or should I go vote? And typically the beer
won. That was an expensive beer, yeah.
Right. So there's a fair amount of regrets flowing around social media.
Do you think it's going to have an impact on the ranking of British universities globally and on some of the decisions that people might make about you know, research and development, science base? Or is this just too early to be able to have a conclusion on that?
I can't imagine that that will be the immediate or a significant part of the impact.
So still okay for our colleagues at SAIS across the way to kind of think about doing some of the firmer studies, perhaps at LSE or something? You don't see any downsides here to the... Because this is, of course, a big part of the British economy as well as the educational sector.
I think everywhere there is an issue, and we've had this at Brookings, of the difficulties sometimes of people who, with whom we would like to talk, getting visas to be able to come and participate in a range of discussions. And the more you're isolated and have separate processes, etc., the harder that process of academic freedom and discussion becomes.
Lots of moving parts. Yes, so a number of questions. I'll take this gentleman over here, and I'll try to get to everyone. We've still got quite a bit of time. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your panel. What would you tell people who are celebrating this as the kickstart of the breakup of the monstrosity that has become the European Union and that you're going to see break apart in the next few years?
Nice bowler hat, by the way. And the gentleman behind you, I'll, yes, Steve, yeah.
Hi. I basically, two questions. One is, what are the implications of this vote for the prospects of the TTIP agreement? Does this basically mean we're not going to see it happen until at least 2018, if then? And secondly,
yes. What was that a yes to?
On this question of if you go back on it, you do a do-over or just refuse to pass the, you know, the chapter, what are 50, Article 50 thing?
Article 50.
What would that do to the UKIP vote in the next election if that happens?
Good question. And then this gentleman here, and then I'll go to the other side in a moment. Yeah.
Yes, Tom Olson. Just following on some of the earlier discussion, so they the Article 50 gets designated, and they have 2 years to come to an agreement, and they don't come to an agreement, and they never can come to an agreement, or the agreement they come to doesn't pass the British Parliament or doesn't pass the European Parliament. I mean, is there a way that this might just end up being in a sort of endless loop?
Well, there is supposedly some procedures in place to stop this endless loop. But let's go back. I think, unfortunately, a lot of these questions are going to Tom here. The first question about the breakup of the EU also ties into an awful lot of questions that people have been asking about whether the EU is reformable at this moment. I mean, Jeffrey had touched on constitutional issues. There's a lot of questions about whether you could have a new EU treaty out of this, a new EU constitution, or, you know, is a breakup now inevitable? Aaron, I think you can probably, Homi as well, weigh in on TTIP, I mean, the problem of trade. And then this issue of do-over and Article 50 and the future of UKIP is also, perhaps related to that first question as well. So, Tom, sorry you're kind of in the hot seat here, but that's what you're here for.
I'll leave the... thanks. I have the some views on the trade thing, but I'll leave that, I think, for Aaron and Homi. On the monstrosity that is the EU, yeah, I think if you think it's a monstrosity, you're very happy, right? I mean, it's got to be good news that Brussels and the elites get a bloody nose over this. And I think there will be a lot of people who, you know, in different countries who do feel empowered by this. But I just question really whether there is ultimately, you know, a coherent sort of alternative vision that's going to deliver for those who are those who are anti-Europe or anti-globalization here in the context of Trump or others. I mean, we have yet to see sort of an agenda for the global economy or even for national economies that will replace the wealth that will be lost by pulling out of a lot of these international commitments. And until that happens, I think it will be a very heavy lift over the long term. For the more nationalist view. But that brings me to the question on can you have an indefinite postponement? I don't think you can have an indefinite postponement of Article 50, if only because of the UKIP point that you made, but also because, when you think about who's in government is the Conservative Party and what way the Conservative activists vote. I mean, they voted to leave. Right, they voted, an overwhelming majority of Conservative Party members voted to leave. And they are choosing the next Prime Minister in a few weeks, in a couple of months. And they are going to demand an answer about when this will be triggered or what the agenda will be. I mean, the Leave campaign may have been at sixes and sevens in the last few days, but they won't be able to avoid this question. And so by the time the activists vote on the next leader, there will be a couple of choices out there. Most of them will probably involve trying to keep faith, at least theoretically, with the vote. Theresa May have a slightly different approach than Johnson, but I think we will see some activity. And then finally, just on the endless loop point, there are two elements to the negotiation, as I understand it. There's the exit from Article 50, and then there's the future relations part. And the question is how to have those in parallel. I think Britain very much wants them in parallel. Other countries in Europe would like to see them in parallel. Some of them don't mind so much and would prefer to see Britain out as soon as possible. But that's why I think you'll see an effort to delay and to try to use the leverage from that delay to get some idea about what a trading agreement may look like or some clarity. My understanding is it is fairly automatic once it's triggered unless it's extended by unanimity. And so there is a end point at 2 years that can't be gotten around unless everybody agrees to extend it. And that, I think, is why London is rightly nervous about invoking it. It's worth remembering, too, that this is not there's no precedent for this. It's not a developed procedure. It's not sort of clear that it was particularly thought through and was written in the first place about how it may work in practice. And I do think you will see the leaders, particularly Merkel, because she's the one major European leader who's almost certainly going to be around for the next few years. I mean, she's highly likely now to stand and win, next year. And so she is the key player, both in Berlin and I think in Europe. And she doesn't have infinite power, but she certainly will be the key player, I think.
I mean, the fact that you've just said here that there's no precedent is a very important point here. We're all in uncharted territory. And, as we keep emphasising, Britain is still part of the EU at this moment. And they have to work out a future relationship. And this is where the US actually does come in quite strongly here. TTIP, you know, has obviously been called into question, and we just had the question about it. But there has been that debate in the wars running up to the Brexit about what, how will the U.S. handle this? How will the U.S. handle its negotiations on TTIP that are already underway with the EU, and how then will it handle the trade relationship with the United Kingdom, which, as you said yourself, is extremely important? And this actually might then give us some sense of how the future relationship, even between the UK and the EU, might play out. So I do think here the United States seems to have a very crucial role. So what are your thoughts
on that? So it raises a lot of questions. The first thing with respect to TTIP is you have to know who you're negotiating with. You're negotiating with the European Union, with or without the United Kingdom. So I don't see any path on that. Two, you know, to the extent that popular forces are now more anti-trade, and not just trade with developing countries, which is, you know, the U.S. and China, which is a much bigger issue in our domestic political, but this referendum is between developed countries within the within the European Union. Two, financial services plays an outsized role in the answer to this question, because one of the key sticking points in TTIP were the provision of financial services. And this was being driven by the United Kingdom, primarily within the European Union, which pre-Brexit was the banking center of the European Union. Post-Brexit, there are going to be two distinct questions. One is going to be, how in this Article 50 negotiation are banks and financial services given treatment in the European Common Market, also known as passporting, will be a word you'll hear used frequently in this question. But it will also be a question between the United States and the United Kingdom. And by the way, a different piece of news that came out in the financial regulatory space touches on this today. General Electric, GE, one of the iconic American companies, who had been was the only non-insurance company designated as a systemically important financial institution, or SIFI, was today de-designated. It was a historic move, the first time any company's ever been de-designated. In doing so, a large part of that was because they sold a lot of their financial operations out of GE Capital to the United Kingdom. So in the Treasury Department's official statement as to who they talked to, they said, we're de-designating it as part of this. We've talked to the prudential regulators of GE, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and the United Kingdom's PRA. Right? It was the Prudential Regulatory Authority in the United Kingdom was one of the three regulators that the U.S. Treasury spoke to in debating this situation. The relationship is special. I'll close with one point. It's very interesting to me that Paul Ryan came out, the Speaker of the House, and said we should have a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. We should strengthen the special relationship. And this kind of gets to the point I think Tom and Fiona, you were making and alluding to about the historical role of conservative governments and the Conservative Party in promoting free trade. Mm-hmm. So I think Paul Ryan is kind of playing the expected role of the leading elected Republican in America, embrace the United Kingdom and free trade and move forward, hold aside what that means for bank regulation, which has historically not been part of trade agreements, but the United Kingdom may feel differently about that. Donald Trump hasn't said anything on that. Mm. Would Donald Trump support a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom? I don't know. The politics of trade do not neatly fit into the American two-party system and is continually to get scrambled. And so how that U.S.-EU relationship will work going forward, I think we need to see that further unscrambling. I think the role of financial services and bank regulation will play an outsized role in that conversation. And then in the, you know, I think it's very important not to leave behind the European Union. Losing the United Kingdom is bad for the European Union in my position, in my perspective. It will move them away from some of the market-based reforms and other common economic structures that the US-UK will make that bilateral relationship stronger. But the remaining people in the European Union may see things extremely differently. Questions about deposit insurance, banking, too big to fail, are very different in the United States than in the continent.
Mm. Homi, I was just thinking as Aaron was speaking here, Nigel Farage, the head of UKIP, were in Brussels yesterday, had you know, quite a speech from the floor of the European Parliament. One of the last things that he said before he sat down was, you know, that the EU should, you know, essentially wish the UK well as it pursued its global aspirations. Now, a lot of those global aspirations have, though Nigel Farage hasn't really talked about this, about trade with China, with India, the old British Commonwealth. I mean, what's the viewpoint likely to be from, you know, those places that you know fairly well about trade with the UK under these circumstances?
So I think in a global economy where formal trade barriers, especially on goods and certainly in services, are already today very low, the real name of the game is about what happens to regulations. And obviously, places like the EU have been accused of regulatory excess and all kinds of undue regulatory burdens. But what's actually being negotiated in many of these trade deals, whether it's TTIP or TPP or anything else, is what are the global regulatory standards going to look like? And in a global economy, you will have global regulatory standards. Small countries and small players will have almost no voice in that. So what those standards will be, these will be standards on data privacy, for example. There'll certainly be standards, obviously, on financial regulatory issues, but going beyond. And that's why, in some sense, these new agreements were actually so important, because they were efforts to start to define what global regulatory standards might look like, and then you sort of set a bar and hopefully expand that bar across the way. So the issue here is not between regulation or no regulation, and, you know, all of those who hope that this will result in less regulation are, you know, perhaps likely to be disappointed, because, you know, you will replace EU regulation with sovereign regulation. Okay, that's a good thing in terms of this, you know, trade-off of regaining your sovereignty. But increasingly in a global economy, the space for sovereign regulation is diminished. You cannot have complete freedom over sovereign regulation and at the same time have the benefits of a global economy and the global free movement of goods and services. So that, to some extent, in my view, is going to be the heart of this battle. And, you know, for many developing countries, they will be looking to see exactly how will these regulations evolve over time. Okay. And will these regulations reflect their concerns and considerations, or will they reflect the concerns and considerations of much more advanced economies?
So the UK is not going to be in the driving seat for a new regulatory framework from this perspective?
They can be, but every time they accept that they want to have national regulations that differ from global regulations, they also withdraw a little bit from the global economy, and it's that same trade-off played again and again and again in, you know, each of these agreements about whether you want to play by the what will be at some point in time the global rules of the game. So, and that's what's now essentially evolving in all of these regional trade agreements.
But none of these dilemmas resolved by this at all. There are some questions over here that I'd like to bring in. If you can bring the microphone down here. Just here.
Yes, Peter Zwack, NDU. Wanted to talk about just the continent and the stability of the continent. The question, and it seems that the Russian Federation has been uncharacteristically measured in its public statements in regard to the Brexit. And my question is, as best you can, from an economic and political perspective, what do you think is in the Kremlin's calculus in regard to Brexit and long-term stability of the EU?
Thanks, Peter. I'd like to bring in David Riley from the British Embassy here at the front as well.
Thank you. David Riley from the British Embassy. Thank you, Fiona. And thank you for this event. I think it's an important discussion and debate to be had. I actually have 4 points I wanted to make, so if you're happy to make them now, then I
yes,
will.
Yes, please do.
The first, I think, is I want people to remember this: the scale of this exercise. This was one of the greatest democratic exercises we've had in the UK in recent years. 33 million people voted. We had a turnout around about 70%. And ultimately, 1.2 million people decided, more than the others, that they wanted to leave the EU. And I think this gets to the point that this gentleman here was talking about. The PM was clear this was a once-in-a-generation question. There was no second attempt. And if some of the questions we're hearing today are about does the next Prime Minister have to obtain democratic legitimacy for the outcome, or how does he or she obtain that, that is a question for the Prime Minister. I would say that while the legislation is not binding on the government, nor does legislation say that the Parliament has a role in invoking Article 50. So it is for the PM to decide, I think, when to invoke Article 50 and the extent to which he or she wishes to involve Parliament. That's actually my first and second points together. My third point is on Scotland. Mm-hmm. Firstly, we had a referendum 2 years ago. The outcome was clear and all major parties undertook to respect that outcome. But in addition to that, the Prime Minister was clear on Friday and has been clear again since that he sees it as his job and the job of his successor to protect the interests of all parts of the United Kingdom. And, you know, this government will do that, and we will involve the devolved administrations, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, in those consultations as we move forward to ensure their interests are taken into account. And the fourth point is just to reinforce a point that you made earlier on, Fiona, that nothing has changed for the UK at the moment. We remain a full member of the European Union with all of the rights and obligations that come with that. But I wanted to make one other point, which has been, I think, debated around town in recent days. I mean, the EU is part of our makeup, but it does not define the UK. The UK remains a strong and leading actor on the world stage in its own right. We are a nuclear power, a member of NATO, and you'll see us playing a leading role in Warsaw next week, a permanent member of the UN Security Council, members of the Commonwealth, members of the G20 and the G7. Whatever the outcome of the consultations will be taken forward with the EU in the years to come, you won't see the US withdrawing, the UK withdrawing from the world stage. We will remain, as I said, a leading global actor. Thank you.
Thanks, David. There was another, yes, so here, I'll take a few more questions and then come back to the panel. We won't forget the initial question. Thank you for your contribution there. Yes.
Thank you, Larry Checco, Accountability Central. To Aaron's point about Donald Trump and trade with England, I think we kind of forget that back in January, the Parliament had a debate as to whether to even let Donald Trump into the country. How much more complicated can this get?
Probably a lot more complicated. Yes, sir.
Peter Doyle, I have an observation about the. I have an observation about the lessons for the US from this that might draw. You have commented so far on the panel about the role of the out campaign or the leave campaign as a parallel with the Trump. I think it's time also to look at the parallel between the Remain campaign mm-hmm. and the if you like the Democrat campaign here. And I think there are a number of important and cautionary lessons to draw from that which have not come out. The first one is that the Remain campaign was headed by people who had just done a complete U-turn on their prior political careers. They made a career being Eurosceptics. And suddenly they find that the Prime Minister I'm talking about finds himself leading the campaign to stay in. It is not entirely surprising that he wasn't believed. It's a basic credibility problem. The second issue was, as part of that, he tried to sell, as substantive, a renegotiation of British relations with the European Union, which he negotiated just before the referendum. It plainly was not substantive from the point of view of the British political judgment. So he was selling a bill of goods, overselling a bill of goods, and people could see straight through it. Third thing, which you did mention as a lesson here, thing which did come up in the panel very early on, is that there were real issues here, balancing wealth and sovereignty. These are not abstract notions. They are real. This goes to the question of the tone of the debate, because the tone of the Remain was not respectful of that fact. Mm-hmm. They attacked the Leave leaders as stupid dimwits. Now, they said lots of stupid and dimwittish things, no question about that. attacking them as stupid dimwits felt very good, made you felt self-righteous. But it's in its hearing to people who might otherwise feel these real issues, feel real inclined to vote to leave, was you are calling us stupid. You are, and it was offensive. Mm-hmm. So while it felt good to accuse these dimwits, as they are, of being dimwits, its consequence was completely counterproductive. So and a key lesson for the Democrats here to take away is that however much pleasure you may take in taking down all of Trump's nonsensical statements, beware how that is communicating to the electorate who actually do have some real considerations and concerns. And the very last thing which the Remain campaign did, which was, you know, which the former governor of England described as the nadir of the campaign, days before the vote, the Chancellor said there would be an austerity budget, a panic budget, introduced immediately following a Leave vote, a statement which was transparently false, had no economic rationale in it, was pure threat. And again, that came over in the hearing of voters as being an affront, a lie, a deceit. And it's not therefore, you know, I think if you really want to look at the source, where the US should look for the source of this shock result, is not so much in the antics of the Leave campaign, but is in the manifest failings of the Remain campaign.
That's actually a very good point. I'm afraid we probably won't have any time for additional questions and comments there. But that is actually a very important point about the tone and about how you communicate in a very charged political atmosphere. I mean, we've tried to be somewhat measured here, but I can say that being from the northeast of England, I don't like being called a dimwit, and I don't think anybody else does. And there's an awful lot of reasons that people voted to leave, which are pretty complex. Some of people say it was the fear factor, and we've got that going on in the presidential campaign, people trying to scare people with different issues. But it's also because when a question is put to you in a referendum, you can interpret it in many different ways. In a presidential election in the US, is a little bit like a referendum as well. You know, people didn't vote just purely because of, you know, globalization factors. Many people feel voted because they wanted to get attention to the fact that, you know, they had grievances and wanted people to wake up. Some people voted because, you know, they saw lack of opportunity. Others thought that there'd be more opportunity by leaving the European Union because of, you know, regulation and other kinds of questions. A lot of people who voted to leave were from the British Commonwealth and didn't like the fact that Romanians and Poles were getting to the head of the employment queue, where they had to find jobs with a certain wage, a certain salary level, to be able to actually, you know, get the job in the first person to get the right to remain in the United Kingdom. Or they didn't like the fact that, you know, there were all of the more competition in the job market. So all kinds of different reasons here. As we look to this question, Aaron and, you know, Tom and Homi, how can we think about that playing out about the tone? I think there has been a strong lesson from that. Then, I mean, David obviously had a number of points that I think can just stand. We had the question about Russia. I can take on that as well. But, you know, we had the question about how much more complicated can this get? I mean, how can this play out in different ways as, you know, we wrap up and, you know, think about this and everybody goes off to maybe have a drink at the pub and, you know, drown their sorrows after this?
Yeah. Aaron. Unfortunately, in America, college students can vote and not go to the pub. Which is another one of our idiosyncrasies with the United Kingdom.
Yes, wait a bit. Sorry, no illegal drinking.
And an intern season, right? So, you know, one thing that I've often puzzled about the tone is that the left seems to derive a lot of pleasure in satire of the right. So you have Colbert, you have Stewart, right? The right doesn't seem to really have those phenomenon about satire of the left, at least not at that level of commercial area. Now, I know satire in America is totally different than the United Kingdom, where we may be AAA and you guys are the big leagues, to mix my metaphors. But I do think this question about tone is real, because globalization and trade and immigration has had winners and losers. And even in economics, if you believe, well, the sum of winning is greater than the sum of losing, so really it's just a question of how we can, you know, move and spread the wealth around. Another term in the United States is pretty loaded. A, we haven't done that, and we failed to do that. B, it's not clear that there's winners and losers, that you're a net winner if you don't have fair trade. One-sided free trade, is the economics of that are very, very different. And I think there are real concerns about tone, and that's measured with legitimacy. On the other hand, it's very hard to have a factual debate with people who don't want to recognize fact. And, you know, if you're not going to have a factual debate, are you going to have a debate about bullying and insulting? I guess I'll close by saying that social media makes elections and referenda and public democracy extremely different.
Right.
And I've been struck by the fact that this is, you know, the first presidential campaign where the candidates are tweeting each other. And that's a direct form of engagement, right? You used to have to just wait to the debate for that. And that's also a direct form of engagement with people. Tom made a very salient point about this is really all a reaction to the global financial crisis. And I agree with that. I'd also point out the last time we had a financial crisis in the 30s, and Tom was right in saying we handled our response a lot better than the Great Depression. That's not really going to win you a spot on Mount Rushmore. But the last time there was an extremely wealthy candidate from New York City who was the son of a wealthy person who connected through a new medium with the populace railing against the wealth. Right? I'm talking about FDR and the telephone.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I'm not talking about Donald Trump and Twitter.
Right. Very interesting. Let me just make, before going to Tom and Tommy, a quick point about Russia, and you've asked about here. I think, you know, for you know, Russian leaders, Vladimir Putin and many others, getting to the point that was raised about how much more complicated can this get, I think that is putting a brake on, you know, some of the perhaps impulses to respond to this right now and try to get ahead of it. We don't know where this is all going to play out. On the security front, this you know, might look very promising, you know, from the point of view of Moscow or Beijing or a whole host of other places. You've got a weaker EU. The United States, you know, anchor to the EU, to the transatlantic relationship in Britain, seems to have been, you know, pulled away from its moorings a bit. Not quite gone yet, but, you know, pulled away there. There's a NATO summit, you know, as we've already been mentioned, and as David said, you know, this is still going to be a major feature, but it looks a lot less consequential against the backdrop of everything that is happening. You know, the global strategy of the EU got kind of lost in the noise. Well, the NATO summit got lost in the noise. I mean, Britain will still be playing a role there, but all of this is going to play out for a long time. But I think the bigger uncertainty is the economic uncertainty. As Homi said right at the very beginning, this isn't really good for a lot of emerging markets. And Russia still has all of the appearance of an emerging market. When some of the Russian economists were through here recently for the IMF and the World Bank meetings, I spoke to a couple of them, and they were not very happy about this prospect of Brexit. They'd been, you know, thinking about what this would impact would have for their holdings and the long-term health of their economy too. So I think, you know, it's incumbent upon a lot of people now to see how this plays out. This could get a lot more complicated. There could be a lot of opportunity, but actually Putin, I think, put it on him, himself when he had a comment on this, that he could see a lot of upsides and downsides for Russia. And I think that that's the case for all of us. Tom and Homi, if you have some last comments on this, sure. Particularly on tone and some of the other issues.
Yeah, no,
being
agree with, I agree with Aaron and what Aaron said on that. The point I would just leave you all with, I guess, is I do think that this is it's obviously a crucial moment, not just in Europe and in the UK, but also, I think, for the liberal order more generally, because the United States needs a strong Europe and needs a strong UK and needs a strong global economy. And I do think that the US administration, the next administration, and this one has an important role to play in this crisis. The US should be engaged diplomatically with European governments, initially maybe to moderate the anger that some of them feel toward Britain and to try to steer sort of the negotiations in a more sort of constructive way to cushion the blow of exit, and then maybe down the road to explore options to avoid it altogether, but certainly try to ensure that if it happens, it happens in as orderly a way as possible, and that is as reduces the net negative as much as possible. I do think it's a negative, but there's better and worse ways of going about it. And now that the decision has been made, at least in the short to medium term, it's important that that's handled, I think, in a responsible way.
That's absolutely right, Tom. Homi, some final thoughts.
I think one of the most striking features of this was how, from an economic point of view, almost every single independent analyst was on one side of the equation. And it really made no difference.
Right.
And,
so much for that. Yes.
Exactly. I mean, I think it suggests that we are in a very different world of how to communicate, what people worry about, how to engage in discourse, and it's not necessarily about the same kind of things that we have been used to using, the same kinds of arguments that we've been used to making, and partly that may just be an inability to actually break through to different audiences, and audiences today, by and large, self-select what it is that they want to hear, and that makes changing of minds a very, very difficult process, because it you rarely get an opportunity for a real, true debate. That will make things much more complicated in the future.
Well, that's a challenge for us here at Brookings, and actually a challenge for all of you here in the audience as you talk about this and engage in it as going out. I mean, many of you are actively involved in this. But I think that's exactly the point. We've got to find different ways of talking about this. We've got to bridge all of the divides that we've been highlighting here. And I'm sure there'll be many more discussions about this. Perhaps you'll be seeing us and many more of our colleagues here for years to come, still talking about this question. But thank you, all of you, for joining us this evening. Thank you.